Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Marcy Ann, and this is my show. Say what? When? Where? And the question I've asked my whole life, why? And last week, I met a Vietnam combat war veteran. And we were sitting there having coffee, and so we started to discuss our nation's, you know, recent re-engagement of the U.S. military in Iraq. And this Vietnam combat war veteran said, yeah, more legalized murder. Well, I asked this veteran to be a guest on my show next Sunday night, and I'm going to call that show Legalized Murder. So tonight, we're just going to have an introduction into the idea of even calling war murder. And next week, we will look at why we should begin to call war what it actually is, legalized murder. Well, the current Webster definition of war is armed fighting between opposing forces, a state of hostility or conflict. You know, when I look something up in the Webster Dictionary, I always like to look at the words that come before or after the word I'm looking up. So the word before war in Webster Dictionary is want. Well, that means a lack or a need, a deficiency. You know, something's wanted. And then next is wanton. W-A-N-T-O-N, which means having no regard for justice or for the feelings of others or for their rights or safety, just totally immoral. Okay, so after the word war comes the word warble. This means a melodious succession of low-pleasing sounds, like the warble of a songbird. And eventually we come to warm, that M after war, warm. And this means giving pleasant impressions of warmth, cheerfulness, and friendliness, experiencing feelings of affection by becoming increasingly content. We're going to look at this in just a minute. The ancient definition, of course, comes from a European word that is, it means to confuse or bring into confusion or perplex. And then another derivation of the word in the ancient Greek is barbaros, from which, of course, we get the English word barbaric. Well, according to Wikipedia, war is an organized and often prolonged conflict that is carried out by organized society. It is often characterized by extreme violence, social disruption, and usually economic destruction for the loser, but can be economically regenerating for the winner, because World War II brought the United States out of the Great Depression. Wikipedia says that war should be understood as an actual, intentional, and widespread armed conflict between political communities, and therefore is defined as a form of violent political intervention. So the techniques that are used by any group to carry out violent political interventions is warfare, and the absence of war is peace. Well, war could be looked at as a result of the emergence of complex social and political organizations as they emerged. You know, that could include education of the masses, and education that perhaps encourages aggressive competitions for success, which would support a school of thought that sees human warfare simply as an extension of animal behavior over territorial or sexual competitions. However, higher densities of population create competition over the resources. So that word want, that is the word before war in the dictionary, could support aggressive competitive behaviors. And then the words of warble and warmth that come after the word war could support the settlement of territorial and sexual competitions. I think our current development here on this planet actually demonstrates that probably all of these definitions of war apply. John Keegan, in his History of Warfare, says that war is a universal phenomenon whose form and scope is defined by the society who wages it. Well, that's true. That's certainly why the word wanton comes before war in the dictionary, because some societies in the past have been totally immoral, having no idea of justice, no regard for the feelings or rights of others. And then there's another argument that suggests that since there are human societies in which warfare does not exist, that humans might not be naturally disposed to warfare. And you know what? There are some specific statistics that will support this premise, because in the Civil War Collector's Encyclopedia, F.A. Lord notes that of the 27,574 discarded muskets that were found on the Gettysburg battlefield, nearly 90% of them were still loaded. And another 12,000 were only used one time. Now, these studies suggest that most military personnel resist firing their weapons in combat. And that human beings have an inherent resistance to killing their fellow human beings. And during World War II, there was some research conducted by U.S. Army Brigadier General Marshall, who found out that only 15% of the American riflemen in World War II actually fired at the enemy. Now, there are those political views that consider that if you are a strong nation, you have the right to go and take whatever a weaker nation cannot hold by force. And Major General Smedley Butler, who was the highest ranking and most decorated United States Marine, having had 2 Medals of Honor, said, "I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service, and during that period, I was just a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer and a gangster for capitalism." And John Flynn, a conservative American author, wrote, "Any aggression is always pursuing a course of larceny, murder, rape, and barbarianism. We say we're moving towards a sacred mission, a destiny imposed by the deity to pursue freedom and justice, while incidentally capturing all of their resources." And then C. Wright Mills, in his book Causes of War, wrote, corporate executives of military businesses are always supportive of any national military effort, since it coincidentally fuels their interest in a stable and planned flow of profit. It enables them to have their corporate risk underwritten by public money. It enables them reasonably to expect that they can exploit for private profit all risky research developments that are paid for by tax money. It is, in brief, a mask of the subsidized capitalism from which they extract their profit and upon which their power is based. And Dwight D. Eisenhower, in his farewell address on January 17, 1961, said, "In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist." You know, at that time when President Eisenhower said this, Vietnam was already developing as one of those potentials for a disastrous rise of misplaced power. And we had already tried to stop war, the deadliest war in history in terms of cumulative number of deaths, is the Second World War, with 60 to 85 million deaths. Now, the behavior of troops in warfare varies considerably. In some circumstances, troops engage in genocide, war rape, and ethnic cleansing, and sometimes the conduct of the troops is limited to merely being a presence in an area, leading to a somewhat largely symbolic combat in which casualties are much reduced from that which would have been expected if the soldiers were genuinely violent towards the enemy. And this, again, would be determined by the society who wages the war and what their purpose was for the war. We now know, of course, that there never were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That was a big lie, we were told, in order to get our approval to start a conflagration there, which was based on the Bush's family and Dick Cheney's insatiable addiction for money and power. Because taking out Saddam Hussein totally destabilized that area, and now we're having to go back in there and stop the genocide and protect the women and children and help the Iraqis bring back some sort of stability that could allow for them to live together in peace. This is the price we're paying for having gone in there in the first place, because we should have never gone in there. That area of the world is totally different from us. And Saddam Hussein understood how to keep things in checks and balances. That's a tribal culture over there that goes back thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Their values are different. It's not that their values are wrong. Their values are different. The way they work things out is different. And so now we as Americans are being called upon to view liberty and justice for all on a case-by-case individual basis. Because you know what? We're now kind of in our teenage years as a country, and we're still under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights as our parents. And we've had good parents, the best parents a kid could have. And now it's time for us to emerge in becoming a global citizen and begin to take a look around at all the other families to see how they do things and to learn that we are not the only ones who know how to make something work. There are other systems. There are other loving ways to conduct the systems of our particular planet. And as we learn about each other and we begin to respect each other's ways, we'll be able to live together in peace and righteousness here on the earth. And we do currently have a president who knows more about this than any other leader we have ever had in the past. And we have 2 more years of him being our leader. And I do believe we will also have 4 more years of this type of leadership. And then hopefully by then we will have enough experience and know enough as a nation to proceed towards taking our place as a contributing member of the galaxy. We are just still a teenager right now, still living at home with our parents, but we are considering the possibilities of our future, and it's looking really good. You know, since the rise of the city-state about 5,000 years ago, military activity has occurred over much of the globe. And when they invented gunpowder and the acceleration of technical advances kind of led to more modern warfare. According to Conway Henderson, there have been 14,500 wars here on Earth that have taken place between 3500 BC and the late 20th century that have cost us 3.5 billion lives. So since 3500 BC, as a planet, we have only had 300 years of peace. So war is seen and understood as a growth of economic competition in a competitive international system. And in this view, war began as the pursuit of nations for natural resources and wealth. However, as we have had these rapid increases in the technologies of war, there has been widespread public concern. And now I believe the power of this public concern has challenged and actually has prevented the outbreak of World War III, which would be a nuclear war. And as Albert Einstein said, after World War III, World War IV would be fought with sticks and stones. At the end of each of these last 2 world wars, especially World War II, there has been this loud public outcry about the atrocities of war. And we the people seem to have now a clearer understanding of the underlying dynamics of war. So the citizenry of the earth have begun to try to eliminate war. And these efforts were realized first in the League of Nations and then finally in the United Nations. Now, I remember when the United States joined and signed the Charter for the United Nations. I was a member of a local political discussion group, and we would have speakers come to our group and present political or social philosophy for us to consider. And I remember that we were told by our current local Republican politicians that we were submitting the sovereignty of our nation now to the United Nations, and we would no longer be able to make decisions for our country that would be in our best interest. Well, since then, I have learned that most decisions to go to war that have been made by Republican presidents have always been economically based. They were never to establish freedom and justice for all. And as for our sovereignty, what we pledge by being a member of the United Nations is that our power as a sovereign nation would never be used again to plunder and rape another country. We would go to the bargaining table and discuss the situation and make an agreement with all the other nations of the world about whatever the situation is. And as a planet, we would decide what is best to try to help. Shortly after World War II, most nations did join the United Nations, and during that same post-war period, with the aim of further delegitimizing war as acceptable and a logical extension of foreign policy, most national governments renamed their ministries or departments of war to become the Ministry or Department of Defense. And here in the United States, our former U.S. Department of War was renamed the U.S. Department of Defense. Well, next week I'm going to have as my guest this Vietnam Combat War veteran, because Vietnam War was one of our country's wars we were involved in as a so-called defensive action. And we're in a defensive action right now, again, in Iraq. But the situation in Vietnam was brewing even as we were still signing all the papers to end World War II. And we elected President Eisenhower, a five-star general who was the first president to take a look at what was going on there. And in his military experience and his military expertise, he decided not to get involved. He felt it was a no-win situation. And then during the Kennedy administration, things escalated, and then it was President Lyndon Johnson who said we had to draw a line in the sand, because things escalated beyond everyone's level, and then things escalated beyond everyone's level of acceptability, and the outcry was finally heard, and President Nixon brought an end to our involvement there. And then the very thing we had sacrificed our boys for, 58,119 killed, 153,303 wounded, 1,948 missing in action. The very thing we tried to fight against became a reality, a unified Vietnam under communist rule. Well, when you look at the results of war, here's what some psychologists and psychiatrists say. War is often a mass discharge of accumulated internal rage. In the inner fears of mankind are discharged in mass destruction. Thus, war can sometimes be a mean by which man's own frustration at his inability to master his own self is expressed and temporarily relieved by unleashing of destructive behavior on others. So, as we begin to master our own self, and as we begin to know who we are in the eyes of God, and to realize our purpose for being, we no longer will need to have wars to vent our frustrations. Psychoanalyst Durbin argues that human beings are inherently violent, and this violence is fueled by displacement and projection, where a person transfers his or her grievances into hatred against others. Well, and he lists races, religions, nations, and ideologies. Well, here's another area where we can begin to transmute war energies into peaceful energies. Take a look at your grievances and your hatreds. Take a look at how you feel about other races, other religions, other philosophies, other ways to do things, and begin to have an attitude of accepting and allowing. We don't have to agree with them. We don't even have to have them for our friends, but we can accept them as being here on planet Earth with us and allow them the freedom to follow their drummer and walk their path and make their contribution to the whole, which, you know what, you might find out you really enjoy. And then psychoanalyst Franco Fornari thinks that war was an elaboration of mourning. He said that war and violence develop out of our need for love, our wish to preserve and defend the sacred object to which we are attached, especially perhaps our mother, who was the original source of love for us, and our fusion with her, both in her womb and at her breast. And for the adult, then their nation becomes the sacred object. And this creates an astonishing willingness of human beings to die for their country, to give over their bodies for their nation, their sacred object of love. And I believe there is truth in this view, because I know all of us need to love and to be loved. And if we are lacking love in a personal way, we transfer our devotions to a sports team or a movie star or to our country. And then we're able to exercise our emotional bodies. We can yell and scream when our team is winning. And we can cry when Michael Jackson dies. And we can feel joined together with the nation as one person when our beloved country is at war. And then Maurice Walsh argues that the general populace is actually neutral towards war, and that wars only occur when there's a time of a crisis in a nation, and the people look for a strong leader, such as a Hitler or Napoleon, who comes to power, and then it allows that power to overflow and wildly continue to conquer, which leads the nation into war. And the way this can be handled by each one of us is by being personally responsible for our health and helpful toward our neighbor. Love yourself and love our neighbor. This is the golden rule, and there would never be any war if a society lived their life by the golden rule. So this is Marcianne. I'm going to say aloha. Aloha in the Hawaiian language is such a wonderful word. It means I love you. It means I miss you. It's hello and goodbye. And in its original idea, it was I am happy with you. My music is by visionarymusic.com. This is music that's especially designed and created for each of us personally and individually and corporately as a nation to make those changes that are necessary in our lives so that we can live together in peace.